I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer, a private equity firm focused on making investments in the cannabis industry. The company considers business opportunities as the legalization of marijuana continues throughout the United States. Some of Privateer's portfolio companies include Leafly, a user-generated reviews website for all things cannabis-related, Tilray, a producer of medical cannabis in British Columbia, Canada, and Marley Natural, a global brand in partnership with the Bob Marley family. The company is located in Seattle, Washington. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica, for having me.
I want to talk first about the history of marijuana. When was the first use of marijuana?
Oh, gosh. You know, there are reports of cannabis being used 5,000 years ago in China. So we know it's at least been used or consumed by humans for 5,000 years.
And where is it best grown?
I've been in this industry for about 5.5 years, and I've probably met the world's best cannabis grower about 1,000 times. Every place I go, every grower I meet claims to be the best grower.
And what is your opinion?
I think that there are different products grown well in different parts of the world. So certainly British Columbia has a well-known reputation for outdoor-grown natural cannabis at very high latitude. You can go to places like Jamaica or India or the Middle East, and cannabis is grown and consumed. It's an interesting product in that it is produced all around the world with very different flavors and properties, very similar to tea.
When was cannabis made illegal in the United States?
So it was right around the end of alcohol prohibition in the early to mid 1930s. Cannabis prohibition started.
How come?
Well, there's lots of different stories around that. Certain people say that it had something to do with William Randolph Hearst and the use of hemp as a newspaper material. He had a lot of investments in the forest products industry on the West Coast, printing or producing newspaper, as well as some of the petrochemical companies. DuPont is often mentioned. Many products that can be made with petrochemicals can also be made with hemp. And so there's a theory that those two colluded to create cannabis prohibition.
And is that your theory as well?
I'm not really sure why it was prohibited. I do know that many of our investors are in this industry, interested in this industry for a financial return, but they're also looking for a social return measured by ending the harms caused by prohibition.
You mentioned your investors, and they really spread across the political spectrum, which is interesting to have those strange bedfellows.
One of the misconceptions about this industry is that it's a right-left issue, and it's not. So we have investors from the far right who see this as a states' rights issue, as a individual civil liberties issue. We have progressive liberals who see prohibition as a form of discrimination against African Americans and Hispanic Americans who are arrested at disproportionate rates for cannabis possession or distribution. In the 1970s, President Nixon declared his war on drugs. And since then, I believe we've spent about $2 trillion fighting the war on drugs. And it's had a devastating effect. It causes a lot of harm and at tremendous expense. So we incarcerate more people per capita in the United States than anywhere else in the world. Recent reports show roughly 800,000 Americans have been arrested, prosecuted, and are incarcerated for cannabis possession or distribution. Those are people who have lots of different rights taken away from them. They can't vote. They can't live in public housing. They can't get food stamps. They can't have their educational support through the Department of Education. And so it's devastated entire communities in the U.S. and has devastated communities specifically in the African American and Hispanic American communities.
What are the uses of cannabis that we might not even know outside of, let's say, the medical, the recreational ones? You smile. How come?
I do, because there are so many different uses for this product that when you start to talk about it, you sound a little bit crazy. So historically, cannabis and hemp were used for things like the sails that Christopher Columbus sailed to America with. Used for rope on sailing ships. The word canvas comes from cannabis. On the Canisoka wagons that were used for westward migration across the U.S., those had hemp fabric covers that you see. It was grown in Jamestown, the earliest colonies, as a vital crop. And grown by early, presidents like Jefferson and Washington on their farms.
When we see hemp, like, is it all cannabis even now?
So it's all cannabis. It's all cannabis sativa. The main difference is really legal in the U.S. It's a legal distinction between cannabis sativa that has less than 0.3% THC. That's defined as hemp. Anything with more than 0.3% THC is defined as cannabis.
THC is tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the chemical that recreational users try to extract as they're smoking.
Yes, it's really the psychotropic ingredient in cannabis.
You mentioned the medical cannabis, and when you were considering starting Privateer, you and your co-founders, Michael Blue and Christian Groh, were researching the benefits of medical cannabis. Can you talk about what you discovered, what you found?
We entered this industry with a healthy dose of skepticism, and when we talk to medical patients, they use medical cannabis for a wide variety of reasons. So I've talked to patients who have cancer and are going through chemotherapy, oftentimes a second or third round of chemotherapy, and the drugs that they used on the first and second round didn't work, but they find efficacy in medical cannabis, typically used to suppress nausea and stimulate their appetite. I've talked to glaucoma patients who use medical cannabis to reduce ocular eye pressure. I've talked to patients who use it for Crohn's disease or multiple sclerosis. I've talked to patients who use it for pain, and veterans both in Canada and in the United States that use medical cannabis for the treatment of PTSD.
When you started to think about starting Privateer, you were working at Silicon Valley Bank in California. It was actually Silicon Valley Bank Analytics. What exactly were you doing for them?
So I was the COO of SVB Analytics, and our focus was on providing valuation services to venture capital firms and venture capital-backed startups.
And one of those startups was an inventory software company for marijuana dispensing. And can you talk about how you got connected?
Sure. So I like to say I knew a little bit about a lot of different companies, and I could typically place companies in 40 or 50 niches, and one day had a medical cannabis technology company from California come into our office. The bank didn't take them on as a client, but it got me thinking about this industry, or if there was an industry, and later that same week, I happened to be driving from San Francisco to Santa Clara. It's about a one-hour drive, and was listening to a radio show, actually an NPR radio show, talking about California Proposition 19. And I thought, well, this is two data points in a week. I need to look at this industry.
What was Proposition 19?
It was a full legalization for adult consumption initiative. That was on the California ballot.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer, a company focused on investing in opportunities related to legal cannabis for medical and recreational use. The company was the first in the cannabis industry to receive institutional capital, helping to legitimize this growing market. The three of you decide to leave your stable jobs, and there was kind of a defining moment when you went to a trade show where you were looking at, various people pitching their companies. Can you speak to why that was defining for you?
Well, the first 18 months, we were very quiet, and no one knew who we were or what we were doing. And so we would show up at these events in, wearing suits, in short haircuts, and I think a lot of people thought we were with the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration. And so we would go to these events. The one you're mentioning was in San Francisco. And we sat towards the front of the room and we would listen to speaker after speaker. And they were on stage just saying these crazy things that no one would ever say in any other industry.
Like what?
Oh, you know, they were talking about taking your, this was 2010, 2011. They were talking about taking your cannabis company public and how to raise capital. And it was just, it was nuts. So we developed this technique where we would sit in the front of the room and anytime anyone said anything crazy, we would turn around and look throughout the room to see who had a frown on their face or who was rolling, you know, which people were rolling their eyes, because those were the people that we wanted to talk to because they were thinking about this similar to the way that we were thinking about this.
It was at that moment where you decided, well, instead of being a venture capital company, we'll be a private equity company. What did you see as the difference, or what was the shift in focus?
That was something that took place over 12 months. You know, we originally thought we were building a venture capital firm that would make passive investments into this industry. And that was our original thesis. And when we went around the world, when we went to various states, we realized that this industry was different. It was a massive opportunity, but there were no companies that were leaders. There were no standards. There were unprofessional companies, unprofessional, unsophisticated managers. The marketing and branding bar was extremely low. And it was a taboo industry. So at the time, we realized we couldn't be passive investors. We needed to be operators. We needed to take hands-on control. We needed to build teams. We needed to build relationships with external teams. You know, everything in this industry is harder. It's more difficult than anyone can possibly imagine. And so, you know, we needed to recruit professional people. We needed to recruit professional vendors. You know, hiring a law firm or a marketing firm or a PR agency, you know, someone to do payroll or accounting or auditing, it's easier now, but it was harder back then. And things that, you know, would take literally a week in any other startup I've been involved with would take 3 to 4 months. You know, finding a bank, absolutely a miserable process.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer. We'll hear more from Brendan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer, a private equity firm focused on making investments in the cannabis industry. In the early days, you had a little motto, which was don't touch the leaf. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, so, you know, for us, we were uncertain about the regulatory environment in individual U.S. states and federally. We were concerned about the conflict between state and federal law. We were uncomfortable 5 years ago touching cannabis in the United States. It's one of the reasons why we jumped at the opportunity with Tilray in Canada, because we had the ability to operate with a federal license in a large country that didn't have any of the conflicts between federal and state law.
Right, and Tilray being a company that grows and processes and distributes medical marijuana in Canada, but and eventually perhaps globally. So then what is it that you wanted to invest in, if not the actual leaf, if not actual growers in the United States?
We were looking primarily at ancillary companies at the beginning. So software companies, web companies, app companies, companies that provided infrastructure. So lighting. Lighting for grow facilities, hydroponics, anything used to grow the plant. So, you know, from containers to packaging, you know, from really anything used to produce the product from seed to shelf is how we thought about the industry.
So these are like second derivative services that were helping to abet the growth of marijuana, but not actually investing in marijuana.
I'm not sure abet is the word that I would use, but yes, to help support, yes. Abet has a, is a little dangerous.
You mentioned the banks and how challenging it was to work with banks because they didn't want to be associated with cannabis. So how did you manage your cash?
So we've been fortunate in the United States, in individual states, and in other countries around the world, in that we've always had access to banking relationships. So That doesn't mean that we haven't had difficulties. Our first bank account was shut down, I think, after 3 months. Our second one, with a very large bank in the U.S., we operated there for about 16 months. And then a compliance officer in Cleveland, Ohio, saw me on TV one day. And we received a note, a letter, saying that we had 30 days to close our account, or they would mail us a cashier's check. I think at the time we had about $4 million in the bank. And so we scrambled to find another bank in the U.S. And our current bank, we've had for about 3 years now, and they've been fabulous.
You had an easier time with the banks to establish relationships where they are holding your cash, but most other cannabis companies don't have that luxury. How are they managing all this cash in a way that's above board?
I've been in a lot of uncomfortable situations in this industry. Probably the most discomforting environment is to be in a room with $1 million in cash, or be in a room with $2 million in cash. It's discomforting, it's smelly, and it doesn't feel like a secure environment. And unfortunately, that's how a lot of the larger, more legitimate operators in places like Washington and Colorado have to operate. For now, you know, they operate on cash. They pay payroll with cash. They pay their taxes with cash. They pay their rent and or mortgages with cash. And it creates a lot of very, very unsafe transactions that put people in harm's way.
Now, did you benefit from your relationship with Silicon Valley Bank?
We did. That helped us to facilitate relationships with banks at the very beginning of this process. Mm-hmm. It didn't help on the venture capital side. When we first started in this industry, we went and met with a lot of individual partners at venture capital firms to let them know what we were doing. But we also started every meeting by saying, you're never going to invest with us. You're never going to invest in our company. And that's a different type of venture capital meeting. It was much more interactive because they knew that we weren't expecting an investment from them at the time.
Why was that?
We had those meetings because we were concerned about reputational risk, and we had a lot of conversations with former colleagues, with our friends and family, letting them know why we were doing what we were doing and how we were thinking about this industry. No partner at a venture capital firm 5 years ago wanted to be known as the partner who made the first investment in the cannabis industry.
Now, what were some key moves that you made or that happened out in the legal realm that were helpful to you?
I think the biggest change that happened over the 5 years is that in November of 2012, Washington State and Colorado legalized recreational cannabis. A year later, both states opened up retail stores. That was a dramatic shift in the environment, that this was happening and the federal government wasn't stopping it. This is progressing at such a rapid stage that I think we're past the point of no return. I think the toothpaste is out of the tube, and no one can put it back in at this point.
You mentioned things that were happening outside the company. You have the wind at your back. But how about inside? For example, a U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration official named Patrick Moen came on board and became your chief of compliance. It's clear what those optics are, but can you speak to that further?
Sure. So Patrick Moen was a special agent in charge of a Drug Enforcement Administration field office in Oregon. And one day while he was driving, he heard an interview with me on the radio. And he had been thinking about cannabis prohibition and thinking about a career change. And so he connected with me on LinkedIn. His profile said he was with the Department of Justice. And so I met with him very nervously at a Starbucks in Portland, Oregon one day in the summer of 2013, and went in, immediately could pick out the DEA agent, sat across from him with my coffee, and he slipped me his card, and he was with the DOJ, but he was really with the DEA. That was my first surprise. My second surprise was when he slipped me a white envelope And I thought it might be something bad. My adrenaline kicked in, thinking that it was a subpoena or something like that. And it was his resume.
That measure, along with the institutional capital that came afterwards, further helped to meet your mission, which is just adding an institutional credibility to your pursuit.
That's right. And so, you know, for us, it was very difficult to raise our initial round of capital, $7 million. In March of 2015, we closed a round of $75 million, and it was a much easier round to close. The key milestone in that raise was that we announced really the first institutional investor to make an investment into this industry.
That institutional investor was the venture capital fund, the Founders Fund, which is led by the PayPal founder, Peter Thiel. How did you meet Peter or his people?
It was a long process. In September of 2013, I was contacted by Jeff Lewis, one of the principals at Founders Fund. He had been looking at the industry and had come across Privateer Holdings, had come across me. He came into my office and I gave him our pitch, and that started a 16-month process where we would meet with individuals from Founders Fund in Seattle or San Francisco or New York or in British Columbia, and ultimately it led to an investment by them in December of 2014.
What about the early capital raise when you were piecing together, it was a forced march in raising that initial $7 million.
It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I spoke at a private equity conference in Europe, and the organizers did a great job of not really telling people what industry it was from. So I got on stage and started by saying, I just closed the most difficult private equity round in the last 10 years. And about 10 minutes in, I mentioned the word cannabis for the first time. And so I'd sort of hooked them. And afterwards, a lot of people came up to me and said, I can't imagine raising any capital for cannabis companies. Yeah. And so it was just, it had its own challenges.
Like what? What's one anecdote, for example, that you can remember?
The biggest challenge is that none of our capital could come from an institutional investor in that round. So all of our capital, $7 million, came from essentially angel investors and single-family offices. And that just, it takes time. It took hundreds and hundreds of meetings to raise $7 million. I probably did that Series A pitch close to 500 times.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer, a company focused on investing in opportunities related to legal cannabis for medical and recreational use. We're talking about prohibition, and this prohibition kind of echoes, in a way, the repeal of prohibition with alcohol. And there's a story of President Kennedy's father, Joseph P. Kennedy, who was kind of in a similar moment to you, kind of seeing the repeal coming and positioning himself in a way that he would benefit. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. So when we were looking at this industry, we tried to find other similar events in history that were similar to cannabis prohibition or the end of cannabis prohibition. And so we looked at the end of alcohol prohibition in the 1930s. And we looked at, there was a Canadian family, the Bronfman family, who generated significant wealth with Canadian brands towards the end of alcohol prohibition. And then Joseph P. Kennedy, who positioned himself well by securing European brands for sale in the United States as prohibition end. And that seemed like the right model. It seemed like the right strategy. And so that's one of the reasons why we focus on brands in the cannabis industry.
Now, the brands that he secured the licenses to were like Gordon's Gin and Dewar's Whiskey, and he was importing. Somerset Importers,
yes,
his company?
The Bronfman family in Canada did something similar with Seagram's.
Sometimes comparisons are odious. Like, how is this not the repeal of alcohol prohibition?
I think one reason why the end of cannabis prohibition is different from the end of alcohol prohibition is that alcohol prohibition was relatively short. And so there was still a lot of infrastructure that was in place from pre-prohibition infrastructure. In this industry, it's really all being created from scratch. It's been well over 75 years, and there aren't robust models. There's not robust infrastructure for the end of cannabis prohibition. All of that needs to be created.
I want to talk about the image of cannabis, which you're trying to change by bringing, you know, like this corporate responsibility to the industry, to this kind of Wild West. You hired a branding company called Heckler Associates. What are some brands that they represent?
They represent New Balance tennis shoes. Probably they're best known for Starbucks, for naming Starbucks, and for designing the original Starbucks logo.
What do you want your association to be?
Our focus is on building companies, building professional teams, building brands that can fuel change. You know, what we learned as we looked at this industry is that this is a mainstream product consumed by mainstream people around the world. And every brand that we looked at 4 years ago, 5 years ago, really embraced the ubiquitous cliches around cannabis. And that was really dissimilar to the consumers that we saw.
So you had this New York Times ad that kind of helped to perpetuate this new image. Can you talk about that ad?
Sure. So it really started as an exercise. It started as an exercise as we were working on the Leafly brand. And we thought, okay, what does the first mainstream cannabis advertisement look like? You know, what would a page look like in the New York Times? And in July of 2014, a couple of different things happened. Governor Cuomo in New York signed the Compassionate Care Act into law, and the following week, the editorial board for the New York Times endorsed the end of cannabis prohibition or the legalization of cannabis. And we took that old ad that we had created as an exercise off the shelf. We rapidly made changes and contacted the New York Times advertising section to see if they would let us place an ad in the New York Times. And they got back to us that same day. It was far less difficult than we imagined. And we placed the ad. And it was really covered around the world.
Well, what did the ad look like? What was the exercise?
Obviously, a New York cityscape, two people in front of a brownstone, one woman jogging, and a well-dressed gentleman coming out of his brownstone apartment. And it talks about the two strains of cannabis that they consume and why they consume them.
There was a New York Magazine article in the fall of 2015 talking about, you know, big cannabis. There are some public health concerns with the growing legalization of the industry, how the EPA or the Environmental Protection Agency and the FDA, they haven't caught up yet. And so people are using just these noxious chemicals in helping to grow the plant, like Avid and Floramite, for example. Can you speak to kind of how you're helping, if at all, to rein in that type of activity?
Sure. Every batch of medical cannabis that we produce in Canada is tested for mold, mildew, fungus, pesticides, heavy metals. It's tested for microbials like Salmonella and E. coli. You know, there's no other country in the world, no U.S. state that tests for all of those things. And every single batch that we sell has to be tested for those things. And so That's why we're interested in Canada, because it's very difficult to produce there under those regulations. And that process has educated us so that we can operate in other countries in around the world and help create standards, help create regulations that are safer for consumers, safer for patients. I think that's the way the whole industry is going. Mm-hmm. I would say that every product sold, you know, eventually every product sold will be safer than the Glad bag that someone can purchase on the streets of New York.
You live in Washington, where recreational cannabis is legal. Do you smoke marijuana?
So I grew up in San Francisco, and I went to Berkeley, and certainly was exposed to cannabis at an early age. You know, it was not something that I took a liking to. It's something that I consume occasionally. I'm more of a single beer person on a Friday night than cannabis.
You run triathlons, right?
I have run six Ironman triathlons. Yes.
Your wife is a ballet dancer with the Pacific Northwest Ballet, and you have one daughter.
One daughter, Eleanor.
What do your parents do?
I'm one of seven children. My mother stayed at home and raised us until I was a freshman in high school, and then she went back to school. She was a counselor. And my father taught high school science for 38 years.
What kind of child were you?
I was the sixth of seven children. We have a friend of the family who gave everyone different nicknames. I was the quiet Kennedy. We were talking about reputational risk earlier, and we were talking about having conversations with friends and family, and that was actually probably one of the more difficult things that we had to do, right? I had to have a conversation with my wife and say, I'm thinking about going into the cannabis industry. And I had to have that same conversation with my six brothers and sisters and with my parents who are older. They're in their 80s. They're far more, you know, despite being from San Francisco, they're far more Frank Sinatra than Grateful Dead. And that was a difficult conversation. And I had to have a conversation with my in-laws, my wife's parents, who are from Georgia. And so there's those little things that you don't think about that, you know, you certainly cause a lot of stress as you're anticipating those conversations.
So it probably helped being the quiet Kennedy, because inherent in that maybe is a responsible Kennedy.
Perhaps. You know, a lot of people were really worried that I was throwing it all away by jumping into this industry.
How do they feel now?
A lot of people that thought we were crazy 5 years ago, now they think we're a lot smarter than they did.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer. Coming up, we'll meet Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite, a company that produces clean, portable stoves for cooking off the grid in developing countries as well as for camping. The stove reduces toxic smoke emissions by 90% by using its own heat waste to generate energy. BioLite is targeting a global public health challenge of smoke pollution caused by cooking over an open fire. According to the World Health Organization, more than 7 million people die annually from smoke originating from open cooking fires. A USB port on the stove can also charge a cell phone or other portable device, which is useful to the more than 1 billion people who own cell phones but lack electricity. Jonathan graduated from Dartmouth College. Welcome.
Thank you.
How does the BioLite stove work?
Sure. So the BioLite stove is a wood-burning stove that recaptures the waste heat and turns that heat into electricity using a technology called thermoelectrics. Thermoelectrics are kind of like solar panels for heat instead of light. And we take that electricity and use it, essentially cause the smoke to reburn.
So how much smoke is the stove actually generating? If I'm looking at a stove and it's burning, am I seeing smoke?
If you see a car driving down the street and there's smoke coming out of the tailpipe, you would say to yourself, that's a badly tuned car. And if you look at an open fire or any sort of wood fire and there's smoke coming out of it, it's the same exact thing. It's a badly tuned fire. What we're able to do with our technology is take that 10% of really nasty stuff and turn it to 1% of really nasty stuff.
You mentioned wood is used to fuel or to start these fires of these stoves. What else can you put in these stoves?
Obviously wood, but also agricultural residues, so, you know, crop waste, corn stalks, that kind of thing, cow dung as well, dried cow dung.
Prior to starting BioLite, you worked at a firm or a company called Smart Design, which helped companies like OXO, which sells kitchen appliances, or Staples, to create innovative products. And it was there that you came up with the idea for a camping stove with your co-founder, Alex Drummond. You worked on this for more than 3 years before you even incorporated a sort of a side project. Did you have sort of an aha moment where you finally got this technology right, or was it more of a gradual process?
No, there was definitely an aha moment. So the project started nights and weekends, and it was really Alex's initial idea. His brother had given him a small wood-burning can with a battery-powered fan on the bottom of it. Alec and I are both pretty avid outdoor folk and campers, and this seemed like a great alternative to bringing those nasty petrol cans out on the trail. And there was this one aha moment in Alec's industrial loft in Dumbo, Brooklyn, where we had built this funny little bent sheet metal thing. I remember us sitting in his loft, and it's smoking, and it's not lighting, and it's not generating electricity, and, you know, we're really scratching our heads, and Alec's poor wife and daughter are, you know, choking in the other room on all the smoke we're making. And I can't remember which one of us, but one of us realizes that the wires were disconnected, and we touch the wires, and all of a sudden this smoky mess turns into this purple mushroom of clean fire, and, you know, we did this sort of inventor's high five dance, and from there, I think we knew we were onto something.
This idea started off as a stove for camping, given your enthusiasm for the outdoors. At what point did you realize, you know, this market could be a lot larger if we address the need in developing countries?
Yeah, so after about 3 years of nights and weekends tinkering, we had what we called a looks-like-works-like prototype, right? So something that really demonstrated the potential in what we were working on. And we took it to an advanced wood combustion conference, if you believe that that exists, in Seattle, and two very unexpected things happened there. One,
this is the Ethos Conference?
This is the Ethos Conference. One, Alec and I were introduced to the fact that half the planet is still cooking on smoky open fires, and that those fires kill more people than HIV and TB and malaria combined. And two, we entered our funny little prototype into their clean stove contest, which they have every year. And we won the cleanest stove of the year, and we were the only stove that wasn't plugged into an electric wall outlet to achieve those levels of emissions. And so it was this incredible confluence of, wow, this really is an important problem, combined with, we have a very unusual and promising solution that this industry had not seen before.
You mentioned it was at the conference that you learned the global scope of this problem. And here you are, a kid from Manhattan and Scarsdale, so you didn't necessarily have much exposure to the developing world prior to this. Is that right?
No. I mean, prior to this, I had been to India once as a tourist. I had seen people cooking on open fires, but quite frankly, I had never imagined that such a prevalent practice was at the root of so much suffering.
I remember my husband and I, we were in Jordan in the Middle East in the Wadi Rum Desert, and we were sleeping in a very large tent one night with these Jordanian Bedouins. And they cooked dinner using an open flame, but that fire was actually inside the tent. Mm-hmm. And my husband, whenever we think about that trip, he's always like, yes, do you remember that night where I couldn't sleep from the smoke pollution? Is it just an education issue that people don't realize that the smoke is so bad for them? Why build the fire inside the tent, for example, versus outside the tent? You've seen that too?
Absolutely. I mean, this is how half the planet is cooking. Specifically, why inside the home? Convenience. Right? Protection, safety, comfort. It's very hard to tell people how to live their lives differently. I think the best thing that we can offer is ways to participate in existing practices and make them safer and more convenient.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite, a company that produces clean biomass-powered stoves that allow clean cooking and electricity access in more than 70 countries internationally. So going back to the early days, once you decided to focus on both camping stoves and stoves in the developing world, how did you go about convincing retailers to adopt these stoves? Were there one or two that were key in this acceptance?
So in 2009, I left Smart Design to go refine the business models and raise venture capital. And I moved out to Berkeley partly to work with development economists and people focused on this issue of indoor air pollution. It turned out to be a very serendipitous time to be in that sector. Early 2010, Hillary Clinton launched the Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves and used our technology as an example of innovation in the sector. So there was really this burgeoning interest. The U.S. State Department became interested in clean cooking and started to put some funding towards it. And so it was a very fertile time to be starting this business.
Accidentally. The timing worked out well.
Completely accidentally. I also spent about half of that year living in India as part of a social enterprise incubator called DASRA, where I was the only American company. It was me and 24 other Indian social enterprises, and it was a wonderful education. I understand campers. I shop at REI. I go camping on weekends. I don't understand what it's like to, or at least certainly at the time I didn't, understand what it was like to cook in a village, to buy things in a village, to deliver things to a village. So those two experiences combined really helped me refine what the business model was to a point where we could take this thing that sounded kind of crazy initially and actually put some venture capital behind it.
One of your early investors is Clayton Christensen, who is the author of Innovator's Dilemma. He's a professor at Harvard Business School. In a way, you are living that Innovator's Dilemma because you have these large incumbents who could produce these stoves, but just the infrastructure and the inertia and the entrenchment of these companies just causes them not to focus on this, whereas you don't have that burden.
I think that's right. I do think when we've seen larger companies like BP, like Philips come to the market, they bring all of the baggage and history from where they're coming from. And so if you look at BP, for example, when they tried to solve the cook stove problem in India, they said, great, we'll be a fuel company, right? So we'll sell these stoves at subsidized rates at a loss, and then we will, through selling biomass pellets, pay the stoves off over time. Well, turns out BP is very good at selling gasoline. BP is not very good at sourcing agricultural waste from 1,000 smallholder farms, turning those into pellets and moving those out through a rural distribution channel. And that's nothing wrong with BP. That's an incredibly hard thing to do. But we weren't burdened with those kinds of presumptions coming into our market.
What were some barriers in the cultural arena that you didn't foresee?
Sure. Oftentimes, one of the biggest barriers to women adopting clean cook stoves is that it's not valuable to their husbands. You know, men are typically controlling the finances of these households. This is an expensive product. Like, there's no two ways around that.
So is it roughly $40 a stove?
Yeah, that's about right.
And these are people who are making $2 a day or
it
varies?
It's a very wide spectrum, but I would say from $2 to $10 a day. But what we have very interestingly found is that the fact that our stoves generate electricity engages men in the cook stove question in ways that men never have before. And it's very funny. If you look at our village demonstrations, there are typically more men in the circle than women, and that is unusual for a cook stove.
Because of that USB connection to their cell phones.
That's right.
What about the smoke? I mean, we instinctively say, oh, yeah, smoke is a bad thing. But what is the reaction of these people who don't see much smoke coming out of the stoves?
Well, my favorite quote that I've heard a number of times in the villages is, well, where did you put the smoke? The conversation isn't so much this is going to change your health over a 20-year time horizon. That's not really what's compelling. What's compelling is I can save you time. I can save how much fuel you're using. I can keep your eyes from watering while you're cooking. I can keep your house cleaner, right? A sooty wall is the sign of a less developed household, that we can really provide these aspirational qualities, which are the same reasons you and I purchase 90% of the things that we buy.
Fashion. Right.
Fashion. Well, yet, fashion and function and convenience.
What is some pushback that you've witnessed? For instance, in Myanmar, some people said that the stove was too small. It seemed like a toy.
Well, so this was interesting. That was a test that we ran in 2009. We said, great, we can use this camp stove to solve a huge world problem. And so the first thing we heard was, well, I'm not going to break my twigs up into a million little pieces, and this doesn't cook for a family of eight. And I think that's when we started to understand, okay, it might be one technology, but it's not one product.
Because the stove was too small for a family of eight.
It was too small, and it didn't cook with the wood that they cooked on.
And how about between countries? So while you ultimately might have gotten a cultural acceptance in Myanmar with a bigger stove, why might it not work in India?
So there were certain things that needed to be different, right? So in India, it needed to cook chapati well, which is a thin flatbread that gets cooked on this kind of conical dish called a tava. And we found for a while that our flames were too concentrated in the center, and so they would burn the chapati, and we needed to find ways to diffuse the flame better. In Ghana, the staple food is called banku, and it's this very glutinous, starchy thing that you stir with a huge, heavy stick, and they actually use bent rebar that they stand on to hold the pots from tipping over while they cook. And so we needed to make sure that our stoves could work with that. But what we've actually found is that, by and large, our stoves work fairly well for most of what you would have normally done over an open fire. People warned us that, you know, you need a different stove for every community, and that's not what we found. And, you know, I think it's unsurprising that it's not what we found, because if you look at what most people in these communities aspire to use, it's LPG, liquefied petroleum gas, so, you know, gas. And gas burners look about the same everywhere you go, and anyone who has enough money and lives in a place where that's accessible uses that.
I want to go from Ghana to Washington Square Park in New York City. There was an introduction to the public of your stoves after Hurricane Sandy. How helpful was that with the PR and raising awareness of what you were doing? And,
sure.
And what did you do?
I was actually stuck. I was stuck in Seattle. I was planning our launch with REI, and a couple of our engineers took it upon themselves to take a bunch of inventory out of the office and set up tables in Washington Square Park and then in front of City Hall and then out in the Rockaways and make people tea and charge their cell phones. And it was really interesting. Even in a city with as modern an infrastructure as New York, we realize how vulnerable we are and how dependent. And the biggest pain point that people found was that they couldn't charge their cell phones and tell their loved ones that everything was okay. With a device as small as ours, you were able to cross that kind of minimum energy threshold.
You mentioned REI. It's an outdoor camping store. How important was REI in all of this?
REI has been a phenomenal partner for us. So they came to us at about the same time we launched online in 2012 and said, we want to launch you guys at retail. And we spent close to a year planning what became the biggest stove launch they've ever had.
I want to talk about your personal life for a minute. You live in Brooklyn.
I do.
In fact, you ski to work sometimes.
I did cross-country ski to work one day this winter. It was definitely the best day of my winter. If it was up to me, it would be winter all the time. It's a little bit weird running an outdoor company here in New York City, but I've always been passionate about the outdoors. I went to college in New Hampshire and worked as an outdoor educator for a couple of years after college.
On a ship, you spent a year as an engineer and a teacher where you taught navigation skills, basically, operation skills on a 135-foot ship?
Yeah. So after college, I was recruited to be the engineer for an oceanographic research program that ran 150-foot ships across oceans, running the engineering facilities of the ship. So the, you know, propulsion engines, the refrigeration, the electrical generation, the water makers.
Now, did you have an interest in the sea? Here you were, you know, a kid from the suburbs, or was it kind of incidental that it happened to be the sea? It could have been trains.
No, I really loved sailing little tiny dinghies as a kid on a lake near where my grandparents spent a lot of time.
What do your parents do?
My mom is a pediatrician and my dad is a corporate lawyer.
Were you always tinkering as a kid?
Yeah, I drove my parents nuts. I broke everything in our house trying to fix it. But growing up, my uncle would give me tools for every birthday. So, you know, socket drivers and all this stuff. And I'd go out to his house and he'd allow me to strap the leaf blower to the skateboard and buzz up and down the street. So, yeah, I was always very mechanically curious.
David Kelly is kind of a grandfather in the product design innovation world. He started a company called IDEO and the Stanford D School. In what way was he influential for you?
I was bobbing around the Sargasso Sea and randomly pulled his book, The Art of Innovation, off of the small library that we had and started reading it. And
on this 150-foot ship?
On this 150-foot ship.
Okay.
It's a closet with some books in it.
Mm-hmm.
Started reading the book, and I think I was about 25 pages in when I started writing my application to become an intern at Smart Design.
You also play the banjo. Did you bring your banjo as you travel the world?
I did. I had my banjo at sea with me, and I have a mini banjo that I oftentimes take with me when I travel in India or Africa, and it makes for nice conversation.
Do you play the banjo while you're pedaling your stoves?
No, but that might be next year's marketing plan.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
Jack, you're free, you're a cop.